From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump plans to issue an executive order on police reform today in an effort to respond to the protests around the country calling for action to address police brutality. House Democrats unveiled a plan for police reform last week. And joining us now is the highest ranking African-American in Congress. The Majority Whip, James Clyburn of South Carolina, is on Skype. Congressman, thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, and you were on CNN the other day, and you said that nobody is going to defund the police. But advocates, including one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter, say that it doesn't mean totally doing away with public safety, but reinvesting money from large police budgets into schools, housing, mental health, et cetera. Do you agree with those goals?
Yes, I do. And I also agree with words having consequences. And I believe very strongly, and I've been a victim of all that we're fighting against today. But I don't want to see this movement destroyed because someone takes a headline and then undercut the efforts. And so that's why I'm saying, let's say what we mean. We want to restructure policing in this country. We want to reorder the way that we do policies and procedures. I have been crying out for restructuring for a long time. And so I stand by what I said, but let's keep the goals in the headline. Let's not put headlines out there that would run people away from the cause.
Well, what do you think will come out of this? Do you think that something as meaningful as the Civil Rights Act or the Voting Rights Act will come out of this movement?
Yes, I do. We need to restore the Voting Rights Act. We know that it was gutted by Chief Justice Roberts. I don't know what can be more important than voting. And I don't see this kind of clamoring for restoration of the Voting Rights Act. That's what's going to save us in November, because this is not just about restructuring our judicial system. This is about restructuring our healthcare system. COVID-19 has revealed some real issues in our healthcare delivery system that we know has adverse impacts against people of color. So right. Let's just stay focused on all of these things and not let one headline kill us.
Well, do you think, though, that Republicans will go along with what Democrats want to do? Or do you think you'll be able to find common ground even with President Trump to get something passed now while the iron is hot?
Yes, it can if we stay together, if we have solidarity. In this cause, we can get much of what we need to get. We may not get all of it, but we'll get none of it if we allow sloganeering to undercut the cause.
You've supported studying reparations in the past. Do you think passing some form of reparations might be possible in this moment?
I always say the root word for reparations is repair. These fault lines that have been opened up need to be repaired. And to the extent that reparations mean to repair, I am totally supportive. When you start talking about reparations in terms of monetary issues, then you lose me, because nobody can put a value on the loss of education. Nobody can put that value on the loss of a life.
I want to just finally ask you about a couple of other major issues. COVID-19 cases are rising dramatically in your state of South Carolina. It just set a new daily high record yesterday of nearly 800 new cases. Why do you think that is?
I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that people are not being as careful as they should be. I think a lot has to do with the fact that do not have the leadership at the national level that we should have. We should not have 50 states doing 50 different things. We ought to have one coordinated effort coming from our national government, led by our president, and doing what is in the best interest of this country.
Will there be another economic relief bill in the trillions of dollars, do you think, from Congress this summer?
Well, if you remember, the House has just passed a $3 trillion bill called the HEROES Act. It's now over in the Senate. Mitch McConnell boasts about running a graveyard, burying good legislation. So there should be another, at least $3 trillion that's sitting there in the CARES Act, $1 trillion of which goes to state and local governments, many of them on fiscal years from July 1 to June 30th. So by the end of June 30th, a lot of cities, a lot of towns and counties are going to be in a bad place.
Finally, Congressman, we all remember the role that you played in helping Joe Biden's candidacy back before the South Carolina primary. As you look forward now, do you have advice for him on who he should pick for VP? And do you think he should accept the nomination for president in front of a crowd like President Trump will do?
First of all, I do offer advice to the campaign on various things. I do so in private, and I don't discuss those conversations in the public. Mm-hmm. But as far as his acceptance of the nomination, I think he ought to accept it like a leader of this country ought to accept it, utilizing the best practices when dealing with a pandemic. This whole thing of needing a crowd in order to boost your ego, I don't think the vice president needs that. This vice president is demonstrating what needs to be done in order for the soul of America, the goodness of America, to be shown through. I've said often, and I really believe, that most Americans are good people, and America is a great nation. But this greatness is under threat because our goodness seems to be dissipating.
That is Congressman James Clyburn, Democrat of South Carolina, the House Majority Whip. Congressman, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Well, let's get reaction now to the news today that North Korea destroyed its joint liaison office with the South, a dramatic but maybe symbolic display of anger. The office is in the north near the demilitarized zone. It's been empty for the last couple of months because of the coronavirus outbreak. But its destruction comes during deadlocked nuclear talks, and it raises questions about who's in charge, Kim Jong-un or his sister, Kim Yo-young. Jim Walsh is here now, security analyst. He's also with MIT's Security Studies Program. And Jim, North Korea's news agency made statements about how this was because the North was enraged about defectors. The news agency called them scum. And the scum protecting those defectors, meaning South Korea. But your thoughts on this whole thing?
Well, first, you have to give them credit. They do have a flair for the dramatic, whether in their name calling or in their act. So this was rather dramatic visual. I don't know how important it will be in the long term. You're right to say that the origins of this in a small way started two weeks ago. The North had stopped answering calls on the North-South hotline. The South would call them and they wouldn't answer. And the North was really angry. They're super sensitive over South Korean citizens dropping leaflets from balloons or floating them down a river that have pamphlets that are anti-North Korean. And now we have this demolition of a liaison building. And you might say, well, isn't that weird? You know, after all, South Korea has been trying to reach out and improve relations. Why would North Korea bite back? And of course, with North Korea, you never know what the answer is because it's a closed society. But there are different possibilities. And you referred to one of the possibilities, Robin. One is that this has something to do with their negotiating strategy and ultimately the U.S. This is one step in a set of steps that is really aimed at the U.S. But another possibility, and perhaps they coexist, has to do with North Korea's internal politics, because you're right to say that Kim's sister played a surprising and unprecedented role in this tiff with South Korea. And it seems as if her profile is being raised. So both possibilities are in play, that this is a tactic on the part of North Koreans that ultimately will lead to pressure either on the U.S.-South Korean alliance or on the U.S. itself, or that maybe this reflects some preparations on the part of the Kim dynasty.
Yeah. Well, and people are wondering, is his sister running the show? Now, I want your thoughts on that. But also, might this also be some, you know, noise making, like, hey, U.S. and everybody's worried about coronavirus, and now you've got these, you know, this race reckoning. What about us?
Yeah, absolutely. And you'll remember we talked several times last year that Kim had said, you know, if we didn't make any progress by January 2020, I'm going to up the pressure. And then 2020 came and nothing happened, but what happened instead was COVID. So we all sort of set that aside. But there's been a number of things. You've had increased rocket tests. You have North Korean foreign ministry officials threatening to disrupt the U.S. election. I mean, the volume of stuff here hasn't risen to the level of a major crisis, but it looks like they're starting to step up the pressure, hoping to wring concessions either from South Korean President Moon or from President Trump in an election year.
Yeah, we just got about 20 seconds. Is his sister running the show?
Well, number one, I have no idea. I tend to be skeptical.
Oh, come on.
Well, I'm going to say no, but I'm going to say this. You know, I was one of those people who said, you know, don't get too freaked out just because Kim disappears for a couple of weeks. It's happened before.
Yeah.
He returned, he didn't look good. So something may be afoot here.
Okay. Jim Walsh, here now, security analyst. He does know answers to these questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
International travel is on hold for most of the world during the pandemic, but not for birds. Scientists at the British Trust for Ornithology recently tracked a common cuckoo as it flew from southern Africa to Mongolia, a journey of more than 7,500 miles. It's one of the longest animal migrations ever recorded. Chris Hewson is a senior research ecologist at the British Trust for Ornithology, and he joins us now to tell us more about this discovery. Chris, welcome, and you called this the Mongolia Cuckoo Project. Tell us what you found.
Well, so last summer we went to Kirk Ringing Station in northern Mongolia, and we put tags on five cuckoos. Four were common cuckoos, and one was an oriental cuckoo. The oriental cuckoo migrated, as we tracked it with the satellite tag, up till the northern part of central Siberia. But the other four birds all stayed around the ringing station in Mongolia until last autumn, when they started to migrate. And they actually migrated southward through China, and two of them actually ended up all the way 90 degrees of latitude away in southern Africa. So, it's one of the longest animal migrations which has been recorded for a land bird, certainly. It begs the question, I suppose, as to why a bird from Eastern Asia goes all the way to Africa for the winter.
Well, did you get any answers to that? Why do they have to go all the way that far?
Well, the common cuckoo is basically an African species which has expanded its breeding range all the way across Eurasia. So from the far west, we've got the British Isles, all the way to far eastern Russia. But until we did this project and its predecessor, when we tagged some birds in China in 2016, no one knew where the Asian birds would end up wintering. And it was thought that they may end up in southern Asia, but there was a possibility that they'd go to Africa. So we were quite surprised to find that they did actually do that. Theoretically, birds should migrate as short a distance as possible to survive, and this was one of the longest migrations, and it showed that they were able to overcome the costs in terms of the energy it takes to fly there, the time it takes them to fly there, and also exposure to hazards along the way. So obviously flying 2,000 or 3,000 kilometres over the ocean is quite a dangerous thing to do.
Right.
And of course, when you move, and you move into a new place all the time, so you're exposed to predators. But spring conditions, as rainfall in the tropics moves from north to south in the autumn and then from south to north back again in the spring. So they're able to follow the rains, and the rains produce the food which the birds depend on. So actually the energy is not a problem for them at all.
And how often do they stop along the way?
So they have what's called a stage migration, in that they actually stop quite a few times. They have two or three major stopovers, but other than that, they'll stop most days when they're not over the desert. The major stopover for a Mongolian cuckoo before they fly over to Africa is in India, where they'll put on quite a lot of fat in autumn, and then they wait for what's called the intertropical convergence zone, a frontal system which takes rain from north to south. And behind that, they have gentle easterly winds taking them across the ocean. So it's quite a safe and probably even serene passage for them. And once they're fattened up and they've got these tailwinds, it's something they could do quite comfortably. And then they gradually move south within Africa following the rains, which leaves in its path a sort of fresh spring-like condition, which produces lots of food for the cuckoos to feast on.
Now, this may seem like a silly question to you, but I have to ask, how do they know that they need to fatten up before that part of the journey? And how do they know that certain winds are going to take them where they want to go?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I mean, I think one of the triggers for them to fatten up are things like changes in day length. So certainly in the UK, we know that if you have a captive, where we actually had a captive cuckoo and it wasn't putting on any fat until we put it outside and it was in an aviary, it was exposed to the daylight. And as soon as we did that, it could see that the days were getting shorter. It put on a lot of fat and was ready for its migration. So that's one of the cues.
And then once they get there, do they then turn around and come back?
They'll stay on their final destination for a couple of months before coming back. If they find decent conditions, they'll certainly stay for a couple of months. But if the conditions they find deteriorate, they'll start to move once again from Southern Africa. So the bird that we just tracked back to Mongolia spent the winter in eastern Zambia. So they do have some stopovers, but they're pretty much on the move throughout the year. So maybe 6 weeks to 2 months at each location is about the maximum that they'll do.
I've always heard the winter is nice in eastern Zambia. I'm sure that they enjoy their time there.
Absolutely. Yeah. It looks very nice for them down there.
Now, what about the birds that you mentioned at the beginning that instead of going down to Southern Africa, they went up to Siberia?
Yeah, well, the first bird that I referred to there was an oriental cuckoo. So that's a different species again. And unlike the common cuckoos, which were all breeding in the area that we caught them, this bird migrated on for 2,000 or 3,000 kilometres up into the northern part of central Siberia. Well, it started to move south after the common cuckoos had already left Kirk, and we were hoping to see where it was going to go, because we think that this species, the oriental cuckoo, probably winters in southeastern Asia and even as far as Australia. Unfortunately, we lost contact with that bird in central China, and we're not sure exactly why that is, whether that was due to the tag failing or the bird itself dying. But nonetheless, unfortunately, we weren't able to track it down to its winter location, which would have been a first for that species.
Now, are there longer migrations than this in the animal world?
Certainly. The longest bird migration is the Arctic tern, which, as its name suggests, breeds in the Arctic and it winters all the way down in the Antarctic. But certainly as far as land birds go, the common cuckoo is actually proving to be probably the longest migrant. So this particular migration isn't the longest, but our colleagues from Copenhagen and their Russian collaborators tracked a common cuckoo 2 years ago from the far eastern part of Russia, not far from Alaska, in fact, in Kamchatka. And that went all the way down to southwestern Africa in Namibia. And that, in fact, is the longest land bird migration, which has so far been documented.
Now, you mentioned that sometimes the birds arrive in a place and they don't want to stay there for very long because the conditions aren't good. Is climate change having a big effect on these migration patterns that you're seeing?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point, and it's something that we're looking at with respect to the common cuckoos that we have tracked from the UK. So most birds are getting back to the UK earlier in spring, as the springs are warmer and therefore earlier. But the common cuckoo is one of those species which isn't. It's only that and the common swift, which aren't getting back much earlier. And they're also two species which have undergone quite severe decline. So we wondered if there's something linking the two there. So we've been looking at the migrations of common cuckoos from their stopover in West Africa before they move northwards over the Sahara, and looking at it in quite a lot of detail in relation to the rainfall patterns. And it seems that the rainfall patterns, when they do arrive, they arrive just in time for the birds to fatten up, because the rain brings productivity, which means there's lots of insects for them to eat. They arrive just in time for these birds to fatten up in time to come to Britain. And it may be that habitat loss rather than climate is more of a problem for them at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Now, from an evolutionary standpoint, why do they do this? Is this really the best outcome for the species to have to fly thousands of miles to breed?
Yeah, well, the common cuckoo is very closely related to a bird called the African cuckoo, which stays within the tropics of Africa. It does move around a bit, but nonetheless, it's a tropical species all the time. What's happened is that the common cuckoo has evolved to migrate north into Europe and Eurasia to exploit spring conditions there. In fact, they're a brood parasite, so they actually lay their eggs in the nests of other species and let them bring up the young. But the same applies, that they're basically exploiting those hosts which are exploiting the abundant insects and things in the spring in Eurasia. Why all cuckoos, even from as far east as far eastern Russia and China, come back to Africa is a different question. And I think it relates to the fact that the cost of the migration aren't as great as we thought, so there's plenty of food for them all the way. The breeding season is much later, about a month later than it is in Western Europe, in the Far East, so they've got plenty of time to make that journey as well. And they seem to have really good strategies for instance, flying over the Indian Ocean. So they don't seem to incur much of a sort of mortality cost for that. And as I mentioned before, there's another species called the Oriental cuckoo, which probably winters, although it's not yet been documented very thoroughly in terms of tracking, in sort of southeastern Asia, northern Australia. So it may be that even if they did try and find another wintering ground in Asia, they would be find competition from the Oriental cuckoo. So yeah, overall, there may not be very much selection for them to try and find a shorter migration in a wintering ground that's closer to their breeding ground.
What is the biggest question you still have about the cuckoo?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, what we don't know very much about is what's happening to the populations of common cuckoos in Eastern Asia. We know that in many, many, many populations of common cuckoos and other migratory species across the globe are in rapid decline, but we don't know what's going on with the Asian populations. But certainly in Europe, we found some evidence that cuckoos from the UK, for instance, take two different routes to get down to Africa, and birds which migrate via Spain rather than Italy seem to do less well than those which migrate via Italy. And there's quite a strong correlation between use of this less successful route via Spain and the degree of population decline on the breeding grounds. But trying to understand exactly what's driving the population declines and therefore what we can do to try and reverse or stem the declines is something that we're really focusing on at the moment.
That is Chris Hewson, who is a senior research ecologist at the British Trust for Ornithology. He's been following a number of common cuckoos on their very long migration from Mongolia all the way down to southern Africa. Chris Hewson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And if you go to hereandnow.org, you can see what a common cuckoo looks like. I must say it looks very common, kind of amazing that they fly as far as they do. But it was a nice break from the news, wasn't it? Today, the government reported the biggest monthly surge in retail sales ever, up about 18% in the month of May after falling by nearly 15% in April, a sign of a rebound after the coronavirus shutdowns. Meanwhile, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell testified in Congress today that the burden of the economic downturn has not fallen evenly on all Americans. For more on all this, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure on member station VPM. Hi, Robin.
Hello, Jeremy.
And let's start with these retail sales figures. How do you square that, such strong numbers, with the fact that so many businesses are operating at a reduced capacity if they're open at all?
Yeah, you have to take it with a fat asterisk because sales in May were still down 6% compared with last year. And people are still subsisting on special unemployment benefits, which could be curtailed later in the summer. So I would not read too much into this 1 month's number.
All right. Well, while we are digesting those numbers, we're also watching the Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell on Capitol Hill today for day one of his 2-day testimony in Congress this week. Race and inequality have been two themes so far. Let's listen to a little bit of what he said.
Low-income households have experienced by far the sharpest drop in employment, while job losses of African Americans, Hispanics, and women have been greater than that of other groups.
Now, it's interesting to hear him say that because the Fed has taken extraordinary measures to try to prop up the economy and perhaps contributed to income inequality. Tell us more about what Powell has been saying today.
Well, for starters, I think the headline here is maybe don't so much romance this notion that everything is just going to go away and be great in some sort of V-shaped bounce back. He did say the longer the downturn lasts, the greater the potential for longer term damage from permanent job loss and business closures. And you did mention their warning about the disproportionate hit taken by low-income workers, minorities, and women. And as a corollary on that, he urged Congress to continue with fiscal stimulus. It was kind of like, guys, look, I've done everything I can and then some, so throw me some more bones.
Well, and yesterday the Fed launched its much-awaited Main Street lending program, which is supposed to provide relief for medium-sized businesses that were too big for those PPP loans that were part of the aid package from Congress. But this Main Street lending program was announced back in March. Why is it just getting off the ground now?
Yeah, Jeremy, it's just such a departure from the Fed's traditional knitting as lender to banking system. In the 3 months since it announced this Main Street lending program, officials twice have adjusted it to broaden the range of loan sizes and eligible companies. There's another easing involved here, extending the loans to 5 years with payments deferred for the first 2 years. And today you did see Powell emphasizing this proposal to add not-for-profit organizations to the roster.
Now, as you say, what the Fed is doing right now is extraordinary. For example, the Fed has never bought up corporate debt before this crisis. They're doing it now. As you watch the markets jump, how much of that is because of the Fed's intervention?
I have to say, just from a gut feeling, it has to be chiefly because of the Fed's interventions, because good news is just so rare otherwise. You consider that the central bank's balance sheet now has $7.2 trillion in assets, up from about $4 trillion at the beginning of March. There's zero or near zero interest rates until at least 2022. The stock market is up more than 40% from where it visited in late March. Correlation, causation, all the above, I imagine.
Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
We're supposed to avoid packed outdoor gatherings, the barbecues and pool parties that have been responsible for spreading COVID-19. But what about moving gatherings, specifically packs of outdoor runners or cyclists? Just one slice of life, but a big one. Dr. Richard Novak is head of infectious disease at the University of Illinois in Chicago, also a cyclist. So, Dr. Novak, some say the thinking is when you're outside, the wind disperses infected droplets.
It's still a thinking, although there's controversy around that. And mainly the controversy is because there's really not much information.
Yeah, well, let's look at one of the few studies. It was a joint Dutch and Belgian paper, not peer-reviewed, but it concluded that runners and cyclists who passed one another could potentially spray the virus much further than the 6 feet we're told to social distance. For a biker going 18 miles an hour, it could spray as far as 65 feet. For a runner at a 6.44 pace, it could spray 33 feet. And even a swift walker, that spray, that exhalation, could travel 16 feet.
Yeah, it's a simulation. They did that in a wind tunnel, so all the calculations are based on the air not moving at all. We don't know if that translates into a risk of infection or not, where the atmosphere is constantly moving. In the absence of information, it would be probably the safest thing to continue to practice social distancing. And what they didn't address is wearing a mask or a face covering of any kind. Obviously, wearing a mask when you're running or biking is uncomfortable, especially if you're breathing rapidly. But there are some other face coverings that you can wear that are not as constricting. I personally use a gaiter, use a handkerchief. If everybody were using those kind of practices, I think it would mitigate to some extent the risk. We don't really know how much, and we don't really know how much we need to.
We know that there's a lab scientist, Ann Hyman, president of a D.C. area cycling club. They have 2,000 members. And she says she's noticing dense situations in multi-use paths. Your sense of that?
Yeah, well, that's what I've been experiencing when I've been going out biking. And most of them are not wearing any type of face covering. And so they're probably putting you at, or me at risk more than I'm putting them at risk, because I do use a face covering when I'm in a crowded situation. And then when the crowds open up and the path empties out, I can pull it down and breathe more comfortably.
Well, passing is one thing, but the Belgian-Dutch study also talked about, you know, people drafting with other people. Runners do that. And they have an illustration of the droplets. You can see the droplets in the wake of the first person, you know, going right into the second person.
Right. So that's a theoretical risk. We don't know how the effect of a crosswind, for example, is going to affect that. But if you want to be really careful, I probably wouldn't slipstream, because that's where you're going to get the largest density of particles. And you probably need to give up on that little advantage you get from slipstreaming.
Well, a couple things. In these crowded paths, people might be unwittingly slipstreaming, you know, running behind someone. And they need to know, too, that you are in the wake of that person's exhalation.
Right. I think that if you continue to practice social distancing as much as possible on the paths, and if you wear some sort of face covering, you can try and reduce any risk of spreading droplets. Remember that droplets have gravity. They're dropping to the ground. And there's also the effect of evaporation.
Runner's World wrote about this in April. They asked the question, is it safe to run outside? And they said, yes, as long as you're alone. UMass Dartmouth immunologists wrote that transmission depends on how long you're exposed and the viral load. And he concludes that more than 5 minutes would be his threshold for danger. But, you know, running groups and cycling groups, they might be together for 2-3 hours chatting, and we know the exhalations will be bigger because they're exerting. So where are you on group exercise?
For indoor activities, 10 minutes of contact within 6 feet is considered a significant exposure. But that's somewhat arbitrary, and it's not based on a lot of data. I think that you can't practice running or riding in a group the same way you did before COVID-19. You can't be that close together if you want to reduce your risk. We have issues now where schools are trying to bring back their athletes. And one approach that a lot of schools are doing is that they're quarantining their athletes before they can start exercising with the other athletes. But schools have the deep pockets to test everybody regularly. Most cycling and running groups don't have that.
Richard Novak, head of infectious disease at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Dr. Novak, thank you.
My pleasure. It was great talking to you.
And several new studies, including one in The Lancet, support Dr. Novak's position that masks can help prevent COVID-19 transmission in most situations. But doctors say it's important that parents understand that the recommendation is only for adults and children over the age of 2. Let's find out more about that and a rumor going around about adults and masks from Dr. Robert Glatter, emergency physician at Lenox Hill Hospital in New York. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Let's first dispel a myth. There was a video circulating that claimed adults wearing masks could suffer from something called hypercarbia. What is that, and is that true?
Well, I want to dispel that myth first and foremost. Hypercarbia is when you have elevated levels of carbon dioxide in your bloodstream, and that makes you really sleepy. And that can lead to the effect on the brain of you stopping breathing, and that can be fatal. So first of all, wearing a mask, a regular standard cloth mask, or even a surgical mask, or even an N95, would not preclude the movement of tiny carbon dioxide molecules.
So you're dispelling that myth, but sort of in the somewhat the same category, a lot of people are thinking about going back to working out, maybe going back to a gym. Those gyms might have to require masks. So what do you say to people who think that they will get sick if they have a mask on or feel like they're not getting enough oxygen when they're working out? You've already said you're not getting hypercarbia, but what are they feeling?
Well, I think there's a feeling that your breathing is somehow impaired or inhibited when you're wearing the mask itself. But it's important to realize that you're breathing in oxygen and you're expelling carbon dioxide actually is functioning normally, even though you may feel that it's not. So I want to just remind everyone who runs, everyone who works out, that it is safe to wear a mask.
So talk about infants and toddlers. You say not under the age of 2. Why?
Infants, 4 to 5 months of age, these are really the at-risk group. They are obligate nasal breathers, which means that they breathe primarily through their noses. They don't open their mouths to breathe. Because of this, if they get a stuffy nose, they have this tight-fitting mask on, they can't recognize and won't be able to really breathe through their mouths. As a result, they can actually become hypoxic and hypercarbic. That means low oxygen in the blood. And hypercarbia means high carbon dioxide levels in the blood, which are toxic. And that ties into SIDS, or sudden infant death syndrome, in some sense, because what happens in those cases is that when children sleep on soft bedding, or if they, for example, have lots of covering, that could impair their breathing, and that could lead to accumulation of carbon dioxide because of airway collapse and also mechanics such as the bedding itself. So this mask issue is similar to SIDS and what we've been trying to emphasize.
Yeah. Of course, infants spit up and grab and pull at things. So when you're not looking, suddenly that mask could be, I don't know, around their neck. I'm wondering you know, if that's an issue too.
Absolutely. You know, when you have these loops, it could form a seal basically over the mouth, the lips, and the nose, and even around the neck. We have to be so careful. And really, these are things which we can proactively do to prevent young children from needlessly dying.
Well, and so no masks for infants, toddlers under two. Is there anything else caregivers can do when they're in a grocery store or, let's say, on a public bus to keep their kids safe? Now, we know that masks are mainly for keeping the transmission out from the person who's wearing it, but people do feel that there's, it at least mitigates to wear a mask. So is there anything else people can do?
If you have a stroller, you can turn the carrier that's within a stroller or turn the stroller in a position where, as you go forward, they're not facing people in front of them. The other possibility is to cover a stroller in order to prevent any potential particles or any kind of exposure. And also washing your hands. We can't forget about that.
What about face shields in little kids?
I would err on the side of caution and really avoid the face shield. There's still potential for accumulation of CO2 and for the lack of airflow. So I think children are really not adept and adaptable to these environmental situations.
And again, this hazard, you know, the carbon dioxide buildup and everything else is because these little people have smaller airways.
That's right. I think you bring up a great point. The airway diameter itself is smaller and air exchange is not as efficient. And because of that, carbon dioxide becomes a problem and the problem in infants and young children, where it is not in adults.
Dr. Robert Glatter, emergency physician at Lenox Hill Hospital in New York, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you again.
Discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. And Noom, a personalized program based in psychology to help people understand their motivations, change their habits, and lead healthier lives. Learn more at Noom and OOM.com.
This is Here and Now. Parents trying to balance working from home with family life may be breathing a sigh of relief now that some daycare centers are starting to reopen around the country. But as Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd reports, some parents aren't ready to send their kids back to school, and that could be trouble for the industry.
Every so often, our four-year-old Marissa peers out the front window of our home toward her empty daycare center down the street and longs for her friends and teachers.
Yes, I miss my school.
Do you miss your school?
Yes, Miss Jackie's not in here.
And what about your friends?
Yeah, Mateo. Oh, my friend.
Where we live in Massachusetts, daycares are starting the process of reopening with some new restrictions. Do you want to go back to school?
Yeah.
Why?
Because I want to.
Because you want to?
Yeah, I have to put a mask on first.
You have to put a mask on first? Yeah, that's right. You're right. But at my house, we've been wondering, should we send them back? Just because we can. Stephen Kramer has been thinking about this too. He's the CEO of Bright Horizons, a national chain of child care centers.
You may, while we're in the process of doing this interview, hear my four-year-old crying in the background.
That is, in strange ways, that's a soothing sound to me, given it reminds me of being back in child care centers.
Yeah.
Kramer says 80% of Bright Horizons' 700 U.S. child care centers shut down when the pandemic hit. And now that things are flickering back to life, he says parents have a lot to consider.
I would just encourage you to make sure that you ask all of the requisite questions to make sure your child care provider is taking all the appropriate precautions with your family.
And what's the top question in your mind?
Top question is, what is different in how you are operating?
Kramer says that should start with following CDC and local guidelines. Will teachers be wearing masks?
How are they handling parents? Parents need to remain outside of classrooms. Are they making sure that group sizes are limited?
And here's another question I have. How will a bunch of preschoolers do that whole 6 feet apart thing?
We'll certainly be keeping children head to toe in terms of how they sleep during nap time. But by and large, it is unrealistic to think that children will social distance.
A publicly traded company like Bright Horizons will probably have an easier time with this new normal. But for the little guys,
child care providers are scrambling to make ends meet and to pay their bills.
Rian Alvin runs the National Association for the Education of Young Children.
The vast majority of the early childhood market is small one-site providers. So it's primarily a small business industry.
And those small businesses are hurting. A survey from Alvin's group shows that nearly half of the providers wouldn't survive a two-week shutdown without government help. When Congress passed the CARES Act, it set aside $3.5 billion for child care. But Alvin says the industry needs at least $50 billion over the next 2 years.
The economics of child care is fragile on a typical day. When you layer in a pandemic and require the kind of low enrollment necessary to be within public health guidelines, then the economics are completely upside down and you lose money by having your doors open.
That's exactly the problem for Jennifer Washburn. She runs the iKids Child Care Enrichment Center in the town of Benton, Kentucky.
We're so small, we don't even have a Target.
And she had this reaction when the pandemic hit and the state put restrictions on her business. iKids reopened this week to the general public after limiting its service to families of medical professionals. That actually wasn't much of a lifeline for the business. State-ordered class size reductions meant Washburn had to cut 20 child care slots, and more staff were required for things like wellness checks.
Now we have 2 staff for 10 children. Oh my goodness, the budget just went meow. And the other yeah with this is that they're working with a group of children whose parents are healthcare workers and they're potentially contaminated. And so wouldn't that be appropriate as a group of people that should get a hazardous duty pay? Yes, it is. So tightened even more. So I think we tightened so much that the balloon broke and we are operating at a $20,000 a month loss at this point.
Which means it costs more to stay open than closed.
100%. 100%.
Washburn tapped the Payroll Protection Program for a $50,000 loan and got another $23,000 from the CARES Act. That money is gone, Washburn's dipping into reserves, and now she's worried about the future of her center and about the kids.
When are they having the opportunity to explore, to play, meet with friends? It's more than just learning ABCs. We have to learn how to interact with one another. They don't have that.
She's on the horsey. She's not on the horsey.
Is she on the horsey here?
That's why my family is tempted to send little Marissa back to daycare. Right now, her time learning is limited to a few weekly Zoom calls with a speech therapist.
On the horse.
On the horse.
Excellent, Marissa.
But we're not sure daycare is worth the risk of infection, even if schools like hers desperately need parents like us to come back.
You reached the end of this activity.
All right, you did a great job.
Yeah.
For Here and Now, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.